Folks, let's get started. We're going to speak to the topic of bipolar disorder, which is a topic that I have really focused on throughout my career, this and depression. And what I plan to do during this presentation is to give us an update where we're at with respect to phenomenological considerations, which directly speak to making this diagnosis in a way that's timely and accurate for people who are living with bipolar disorder. And I want to really take a pragmatic approach to treatments. And throughout the presentation, I'm going to interweave clinical pearls and just some commentary about some of the nuance, because this is clearly a nuanced disorder. And in the clinical ecosystem, we're often being asked to treat nuance. I'm going to try and capture that throughout this presentation, which we're calling the rainbow. This is, in fact, just a summary of what I'm just describing, but really, in fact, bringing us close to the point of care, sketch the portrait of what bipolar looks like in the real world natural habitat. How can we efficiently screen, get this diagnosis made timely and accurately, and let's get people on the best available treatments to give them the best chance for success going forward. So the word that emanates for me from this slide is the word change. In other words, the topic of bipolar disorder always evokes in me change. First of all, the label, the moniker has changed many times. It was once called manic depression. Bipolar disorder came into our vocabulary in 1980 with the DSM-3. That was subsequently augmented with bipolar II disorder in 1994. Then we had the mixed features specifier that was introduced in 2013. And you probably all know just last month, there was the DSM-5 text revision. No significant changes to the moniker, the description of bipolar disorder. But why I always say change is because what I'm enumerated here is really the changing therapeutic objectives. Across time, within an individual, yes, we're asked to treat mania and depression, but in day-to-day practice with people living with bipolar disorder, you and I are often asked to, in many cases, simultaneously target, yes, difficulties with sleep and circadian rhythms, problems with comorbidity, problems with cognition. We see so many people who complain of, despite feeling otherwise well, that they're very affectively reactive. There's a lot of instability of their mood. And very often people will complain of really significant difficulties around thoughts of self-harm and suicide. So really this is what I would call a five-alarm fire. There's so many therapeutic objectives that we are trying to address within an individual across time, and depending on each individual, one or more emerges, gets democratized, if you will, as the primary therapeutic target. So our work is cut out for ourselves. I think where the work begins is making the diagnosis. And the age at onset of bipolar disorder is early in life. I call it the 75-25 rule, that 75% of people with bipolar disorder manifest the illness before the age of 25. One of the questions was age at onset of bipolar in the ARS questions. What's really interesting is that the age at onset of bipolar disorder here in the United States is 10 years earlier than it is in Europe, 10 years earlier. That itself is interesting because that speaks to possible causative factors or moderational factors. Some reasons that have been put forward as to why it might be earlier here in the United States and Canada is because of the higher rate of exposure to illicit drug and alcohol. The other reason that's been put forward is the higher exposure to antidepressants here in North America versus Europe. And one final point is called assortative mating. In other words, when you look at people in America and Canada who have bipolar disorder, they are much more likely to have parent or parents plural who also have a serious mental illness when compared to Europe. So these factors may be explaining this very significant early age at onset. But the other factor I want to just speak to related to this is trauma. We know that about, depends on how it's defined, how it's measured, which sample we're looking at, but around 30 to 70% of people with bipolar disorder report childhood maltreatment. And you all see these patients on a daily basis. These are folks who are suffering related to trauma. The trauma also predisposes obesity and diabetes and heart disease. But these data tell us that when you intersect family history with exposure to trauma. There's an earlier age at onset of bipolar. This is a heat map. Red means red hot. Top right-hand corner, these folks who have a high family loading for bipolar disorder, as well as histories of childhood trauma, are more likely to manifest an earlier age at onset. This speaks to epigenetic modification perhaps going on. So these are people at risk, exposed to this pathogenic environment, which is then sort of forwarding and progressing the vulnerability to the clinical arena. In contradistinction, in the bottom left-hand corner in the blue, these are people who have low family history recording and do not have childhood abuse histories. Their age at onset's much higher. And this is a very important concept, not just mechanistically, but I think for me clinically, the great majority of people I see in my program, in fact, report childhood trauma. And this does shape the care plan with respect to simultaneously addressing those aspects with psychosocial treatments. But it's also, in fact, set the stage for what I made quick reference to, that being obesity and diabetes and heart disease, which affects at least half of people living with bipolar. Now, when I see a person and you see a person with bipolar disorder who's had one episode of mania or one episode of hypomania alternating with one depression, that person is a very different person than the person who's had 5 to 10 episodes. And what I mean by that is if we look under the hood and we look, for example, at brain structure, brain function, brain circuit connectivity, we see a very, very different portrait. This is some data that just reminds us that with each episode of bipolarity, there's progressive thinning, loss of brain tissue. So there is this neurodegenerative aspect that's taking place in groups of people with bipolar disorder. I've often wondered whether this is the underlying substrate that subserves the cognitive decline that we so often see in our patients as a function of each episode. They lose more and more cognitive abilities. It's also made me wonder whether or not this may explain why over time, people with bipolar disorder begin to in fact appear more and more mixed. In other words, early in the illness course, it may be more episodic with mania and depression, and then over time, we begin to see this chronic non-recovery, mixed confluence of anxiety, irritability, and depression. Those are thoughts for another day, but the point I want to leave you with is that this is a highly progressive condition. We talk about changing the moniker, changing the name. Colloquially, we talk about the bipolar spectrum. And you've all seen slides like this where we conceptualize depression at one end and bipolar at the other end. I'm not sure that's entirely valid, but it makes sense. It has a certain kind of appeal to it. But what I wanted to really focus on is the bottom rectangle towards the right. Day to day, people who live with bipolar disorder spend most of their time depressed. In fact, the percentage of time spent depressed versus hypomanic or manic is around 70% versus 30%, sometimes 80% to 20%. People with bipolar II disorder spend even greater amount of their time in a depressive state. One of the notions I was taught when I was very early in my career is that bipolar II disorder is a milder form of bipolar disorder. I sometimes refer to this as the decaffeinated bipolar disorder. Well, so untrue. It turns out that bipolar disorder is as burdensome as bipolar I. Bipolar II disorder has more chronic, more recurrent depression. It also has a higher rate of rapid cycling when compared to bipolar I, has higher rates of comorbidity when compared to bipolar I, and has a higher suicide completion rate than bipolar I. So my conclusion is this is just as severe, if not more severe, as is bipolar I. The challenge we have is to make this diagnosis. So to orient you to the slide, this is what's called inter-observer agreement. To what degree do professionals agree on the diagnosis? Benchmark, we want at least 0.4 agreement. Bipolar II just makes the cut, coming in at 0.4. Bipolar I comes in at 0.56. So what I can take away from this is bipolar I disorder has got relatively good inter-observer agreement. Bipolar II is a bit fuzzy. Look at major depressive disorder, coming in at 0.2. 2.8, so quite low. So what I take away from this is the more depression the patient's experiencing who comes into the clinic for consultation, the more they've been experiencing depression, the greater the likelihood we're going to make a misdiagnosis. And this is something always to keep in mind in every depressed patient presenting, the possibility that that depression is more parsimoniously explained by bipolar disorder. Now, one of the aspects about bipolarity is that not only is depression polarity predominant, but depression is polarity first. And what that means is that depression is the first clinical presentation. Take a good history. The patient has no hypomania or mania yet. Mother Nature's holding the card. And so what we see is this transition across time. I call it the 1% to 2% rule. So if we had 100 people in our office today with depression, no current past history, hypomania, or mania, and they come back 10 years later, between 10 and 20 of them now have declared bipolarity. This is why when you diagnose major depressive disorder and the patient returns a year later, 3 years later, 7 years later, not uncommonly the presentation changes. They start complaining of more anxiety, more irritability. The antidepressant's not working as well anymore. Now that doesn't necessarily mean, aha, they have bipolar disorder, but what it does in fact mean is I'm gonna have to maybe rethink this diagnosis. And before I call you treatment-resistant major depression, let's make darn sure you don't have underlying bipolarity. So the diagnosis is based on what we call a set of probability factors. We don't have a blood test, we don't have an MRI scan, so it's about a deep domain clinical assessment. Age at onset, we talked about the 75-25 rule. Bipolarity, in the field we often debate this issue, it's kind of an interesting debate, is the problem is the lesion bipolar, high and low, or is the lesion cyclicity, that they have a problem with cycling, cycling of their rhythms, whether it's their sleep rhythms, other vegetative rhythms, is it cycling of their cognition and their mood? And we debate this a lot in this field. But my point is that on average, persons with bipolar have more episodes of affective illness. They tend to also have more comorbidity, whether that be psychiatric or medical comorbidity. And we know about substance and alcohol misuse. The most common category of comorbidity and bipolarity is the anxiety disorders. But we also don't forget about ADHD and binge eating disorder. On the medical side, migraine, 20 to 70% of patients with bipolar have migraine. Incredible association. I always ask patients about migraine. And also obesity and diabetes and heart disease, we'll get into that in a moment. Family history. Now, patients don't usually say, well, sometimes they do, my mom has bipolar 1 disorder, rapid cycling, treat it with lithium. They don't usually say that. They say, I don't know. The phrase, I don't know, is the most frequent phrase in my office. I don't know. Does your sister have mental illness? I don't know, but she takes Prozac. Okay, so we take a deep dive into those issues. So my point is, you take in a history in an ideal world, which I vacated a long time ago, but in an ideal world, you hear a history of this diagnosis, that diagnosis. But what you're listening for is that mental illness or treatment of mental illness or suicides in the family. Finally, antidepressants. Antidepressants are largely ineffective in most people with bipolar disorder. They can aggravate the situation and they can certainly in some people destabilize them, but the most common outcome is they just don't work. So you all know when you're with patients, you take this history and you're still thinking, I don't know if you have bipolar disorder or not. And you're still scratching your head and you're looking for some more probability factors. Does the patient have atypical symptoms? Hyperphagia, hypersomnia, more common in bipolar. Are they psychotic? More common in bipolar. Do they have what I call the four A's? Are you anxious? Agitated? Are you angry? Do you have attentional problems? And the patient will say, oh, you know, Dr. Becker, I'm so anxious, I can't sleep. I'm so irritable, I'm so agitated. I can't focus. I'm certain I got ADHD. I need Adderall. Please give me some Adderall. So when you hear this story, anxiety, agitation, anger, attention, you are really suspicious this could be underlying mixed features. And the mixed features affects about a third to half of people during depression. So no surprise, most people with bipolar disorder who visit a care provider, doesn't matter which type of care provider, exit the office with a diagnosis of depression and or anxiety. Those are the two most common diagnoses. This is delaying initiation of appropriate treatment, and this is increasing the likelihood of inappropriate treatment and also leaving patients obviously suffering and at risk. And what this slide is telling us is that as you prescribe more and more antidepressants to someone with depression and anxiety, and those antidepressants aren't working, there's a greater probability this person has bipolar disorder. So we're in the game of probabilities, looking for that phenomenology, atypical symptoms, my four A's, a good history, response to treatment, of course, family history. I spent most of my career looking at comorbidity and mood disorders. We know they're common. We know that they are burdensome. They have their own morbidity, their own mortality. In fact, in the area of bipolar disorder, the years of life lost is estimated around 10 to 20. And this is largely from cardiovascular disease. I've been really curious in some of the pediatric bipolar literature now coming out is that 15-year-olds with bipolar disorder have heart disease. They have subclinical evidence of vascular disease. And this has been replicated by different groups. And not only is the conditions more common, but they occur at a much earlier age of life. So these so-called age-related diseases like hypertension, diabetes, dementia, et cetera, they occur much earlier, 10, 15, 20 years earlier. So not only is lifespan shortened, but healthy lifespan is shortened. And that's a different concept. Women seem to have the short end of the stick. They seem to have more comorbid conditions. And in part, this could be because they're more likely to be victims of trauma. That's not the only explanation, but that's certainly one that would be a suspect in the suspect line for me. And what's interesting is that although on average, men drink more alcohol, use more drugs than women, that's well known, the relative risk is higher in women with bipolar disorder. So women, in fact, really get the short end of the stick, unfortunately, when it comes to comorbidity. And this is a study that documented the relationship between childhood maltreatment and the likelihood you're going to have medical comorbidity and bipolar disorder. And this is in keeping with what's been reported in other areas of medicine, the link between trauma, pathogenic exposures, economic insecurity, housing insecurity, other social determinants, and risk of onset of these chronic non-communicable disorders. I want to come back to this issue of metabolics because it's so pertinent to bipolar disorder, the care of our patients, the selection of treatment, and also some of our mechanistic models. So for those of you who in fact like percentages like me, it is in fact the case that half of people who have bipolar disorder, 50%, meet the criteria for the metabolic syndrome. That compares to about 20 to 24% in the general population, so obviously twice the risk. We recently looked at this issue. This is a summary of looking at the rate of diabetes and prediabetes. It turns out that the rate of diabetes type 2 in bipolar is at 20%, prediabetes 30%, adds up to 50%. The risk of obesity is doubled in this population. So where am I going with this? This is in part of the illness. In other words, if you have bipolar disorder and you've never been exposed to a psychotropic medication and you're an Olympic athlete, you are still at higher risk of diabetes. It's part of the illness. The other part about this, which is relevant to what you and I do, is that as your BMI goes up and as your insulin resistance goes up, you're more likely to present to the clinician depressed. There's something about obesity and more specifically insulin resistance that changes the brain's function in such a way that the patient is more vulnerable to anhedonia, cognitive impairment, and anxiety. Isn't that interesting? Because mixed features, which is characterized by my four A's, is more common in people who are obese and diabetic. That's why we always say in bipolar, diabetes, obesity metastasizes to the brain as a metaphor for the crosstalk that's occurring between the periphery and the brain.
This is a look at inflammation. I'm going to highlight something for you here. You've all been hearing a lot about inflammation and its role in causing and possibly even treating mental illness. But what I want to really highlight is something more narrow. The association between inflammation and depression, particularly, is a conversation about anhedonia, a conversation about motivation, fatigue, cognitive problems. Those are the phenomenological characteristics that are most linked to inflammation. And isn't it interesting that as you have more medical comorbidity, notably inflammatory comorbidity like obesity and diabetes, your depression tends to be more anhedonic. That is, you tend to have profound reductions in the anticipation and the experience of pleasure. And this is the enemy of the state. This is what destroys quality of lives for people, reduces their function, and reduces, in fact, their motivation to take treatment and their motivation to participate in the care plan. This was a study we published about 6 months ago in JAMA Psychiatry. We found that if you have bipolar disorder, you're more prone to get COVID. You're more prone to end up in hospital and die from COVID when compared to the general population. It's been subsequently now reported that if you get the vaccine, you're more prone to get breakthrough infections. So this speaks to social determinants, but also speaks possibly to the immune dysregulation in this population. But here's actually a little good news. There's also, in fact, a hint, not a conclusion, but a hint, that if you take psychotropic medication for serious mental illness like bipolar disorder, that might protect you a little bit with respect to giving a little musculature to your immune reaction. I'll come back to that in a few moments. But for now, I want to, in fact, really not depart this topic of misdiagnosis. It's absolutely critical. The duration of untreated illness, DUI, which sometimes means driving under the influence, but DUI is duration of untreated illness. And that has been reported variably. Most estimates come in at about, 5 to 7 years for bipolar 1 disorder, 10 to 15 years for bipolar 2 disorder. The guys get the short end of the stick on this one because it turns out that guys with bipolar disorder, it takes us longer to diagnose them than it does the women for a variety of reasons. Perhaps part of this is just healthcare utilization and exposure. But this is, in fact, a huge modifiable deficiency. Here's one point I want to leave with you. When we look at suicide behavior in bipolar disorder, we know that the risk is elevated throughout the entire life of the person. But the risk is highest in the first 5 to 8 years of the illness. And that's exactly the window that they're most likely to be misdiagnosed. So this is, in fact, another reason this call to action is loud and clear. I want you to remember the one-thirds. One-third of people who've had a manic episode reach recovery fully 2 years later. I can do the math, so can you. Two-thirds have not recovered in 2 years, fully recovered. This speaks to the lingering depression, the lingering cognitive problems, probably also some of the residual interpersonal fallout, the vocational fallout, in many cases the professional difficulties. So this is really about getting people diagnosed and getting them on the right treatment as soon as possible. This is a screening tool. It won't diagnose bipolar, but it will save you time. If patients screen negative, you can hurry along. They probably don't have bipolar disorder. If they screen positive, you gotta roll your sleeves up. 4 of 6 is a positive screen, free of charge, download it. I have been frustrated with screening tools because I like them, the ones previous. They're brief, patient administered, not bad, negative predictive value. If you screen negative, you don't have it. But too many patients come to my office and they say, I screen positive for bipolar disorder. I got bipolar disorder. And they don't have bipolar disorder. And so we have too many false positives. And you know what it's like when someone comes to your office, I've got bipolar disorder, and they don't. Then you have to tell them, you don't have bipolar disorder. I have to depolarize you. And they sort of say, why are you depolarizing me? Well, you don't have it. And this is a very awkward conversation many, many times. So we tried to improve upon that with this new screener, the Rapid Mood Screener, and that should get you sort of a few extra minutes saved if they have a negative screen, time to really go down deep if you have a positive screen. So in this article that I published, I wanted to bring together in a very succinct way these drop-down menus. Bipolar disorder is so complicated phenomenologically and diagnostically. And then to add more complexity, the treatments are very different. I don't just mean safety and tolerability, but on the efficacy profile. And I remember when I started, patients with bipolar would go on a mood stabilizer. The words mood stabilizer means nothing anymore. It used to mean lithium and valproate and carbamazepine, but that's not what it even means anymore. So we kind of get rid of that language. And now we talk about the different treatments and what effects they have across the different phases of the illness. So what I'll do, just focus on bipolar depression. That's the enemy of the state. That's the most common presentation. That's the most common presentation in clinics. We have very few options. And when you start to filter the medicines as a function of weight gain liability and diabetes, we have even fewer. So for example, we have cariprazine, lurasidone, and lumateperone, because quetiapine, olanzapine, fluoxetine, these agents have significant weight gain and metabolic disruption. I want to highlight lamotrigine. Lamotrigine is not FDA approved for bipolar depression, but it's not uncommon to adjunctively administer it in people who have bipolar depression acutely. Antidepressants, not recommended, or not FDA approved, but we're going to see very quickly here that they are very often prescribed. So in bipolar disorder, the modal number of medications people are prescribed is between 3 and 6. So polypharmacy is the rule, not the exception in this population, albeit polypharmacy is much more common later in the illness course than earlier. It makes us wonder whether if we can get them diagnosed and treated in a way that's more appropriate, that might decrease the likelihood of having such complex polypharmacy regimens. One of the questions I'm looking at right now in an analysis is whether or not some of the newer atypical antipsychotics approved in bipolar depression, because they have a broader spectrum of effect, can that decrease the need for so much medications being co-prescribed? I don't think anyone would take offense to reducing the number of medications. Lurasidone shown to be effective in bipolar depression. This has been with us now for the better part of a decade, monotherapy and adjunct. Because of the medication's engagement of certain receptors like the 5-HT7, like Trintellix, 4-deoxetine, there's been this lingering hypothesis, can this medication improve cognition? And that's one that we're still cogitating. We still don't know yet if that's indeed the case, but we have a reason to believe it could be. Some recent data showing that lurasidone could improve anhedonia in people with bipolar depression, which again, as I said, is a very common and very debilitating part of depression. And it's been shown to treat those 4 A's. In other words, the mixed features presentation, both in the bipolar population and in people with MDD. That is, people with major depressive disorder who don't have bipolar disorder, about 25% of them have mixed features. Lurasidone's been shown to be effective in treating that not uncommon presentation of major depressive disorder. Now, recently we've had cariprazine, since about 2018, was approved in bipolar disorder. And this is an agent that's approved in mania, mixed, and depression. So you have lurasidone in bipolar depression type 1, cariprazine's approved in mania, mixed, and bipolar depression type 1. And this is a drug that really preferentially engages the D3 receptor very quickly. The D3 receptor is located in the cognition control in the reward center of the brain. That gives you a little hint as to what it might be doing, and there are evidence to show that animals who take cariprazine are less anhedonic, they're a little smarter, and when you, in fact, run these analyses, what you're finding now in people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, there are some hints of improvement now in their cognition. I'd love to see a study with cariprazine in bipolar disorder with comorbid alcohol and drug abuse, given the role of D3 in modulating alcohol and drug misuse. There are some data to show that D3 modulation could reduce that, and we look forward to seeing if that study is done. This is data in bipolar depression type 1 with and without mixed features. And cariprazine, perhaps because of that effect on D3, is alleviating not just anhedonia, but also improving some of these cognitive elements that we think are so critical to mixed. In these patients who present with such hostility and agitation and irritability,
are exhibiting an improvement. And this is also seen in some of the hostility outcomes in schizophrenia, where this medication is also been approved. Now, the FDA currently is reviewing cariprazine for potential augmentation of its label to now include major depression. The data have been submitted. We have data also in major depressive disorder, just like aripiprazole, brexpiprazole, wherein cariprazine has now been shown to be antidepressant when added to conventional antidepressants. So during COVID, we were giving psychiatric medications to treat COVID. You probably all heard that fluvoxamine is being used to treat acute COVID infection. We have a study underway where we're placebo-controlled trial giving vortioxetine, Trintellix, to try and treat long COVID syndrome, a very different phenomenon we'll talk about this afternoon. Well, this is the reversal. This is actually a drug that was once an anti-bug drug. This is lamotrigine. It was derived from a drug called pyrimethamine, which is an anti-malarial drug. And this anti-malarial drug became lamotrigine, became an antidepressant, but it's a recurrence prevention drug. Its benefit clearly is observed. It has an FDA approval for the prevention of depression, but not for acute depression. And it is a very, very good antidepressant, especially when it's added to lithium or some of the newer atypical antipsychotics. Lumateperone is a newer kid on the block, and this drug is approved in bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. So remember that one of those ARS questions about bipolar 1, bipolar 2? So lumateperone and quetiapine are the only two drugs that have been FDA approved in bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, and this agent was studied in both monotherapy and as adjunct to lithium and valproate. And the point about this medication is its blockade of dopamine is considerably lower than we're used to. And because of that, it is thought that there's less likely to see EPS. You're less likely to see prolactin elevation and less likely to see that kind of drug effect that many patients with high D2 blocking agents will complain of. We've been able to show that this agent, yes, treats depression, BP1, BP2, alone or as an adjunct, but also helps patients with those very, very commonly encountered mixed features. There's actually been an attempt now to look at this medicine with respect to its ability to improve anhedonia, but also can this medication improve cognition? So this is a nice dashboard, just provides a summary because we've had these five atypical agents that are FDA approved in the acute phase. So you can see lumateperone in monotherapy adjunct lithium to valproate. And you can see quetiapine also has BP2, but has the liability of weight gain. And then you have lurasidone in bipolar depression, and cariprazine also has mania in mix. That's an important point to emphasize with cariprazine. But coming back to lamotrigine, where it really seems to have a 1+1=3 effect is when it's added to something else. And lithium plus lamotrigine, I call that double L therapy, are in fact very, very, very commonly prescribed in my office. So the heat map just speaks to weight, metabolic changes, and this is something we all know. You're all monitoring for this. And this obviously changes the calculus with respect to quetiapine insofar as it has these problems, and that has undermined some of its acceptability with patients. And obviously, it's not the only adverse event category, but a major one in this particular group. And that segues into a relatively new approval, olanzapine samidorphan. This is the combination of an antipsychotic and an opioid antagonist. I'm always asked, what's the difference between samidorphan and naltrexone? It's very different, pharmacodynamically, pharmacokinetically, and behaviorally, they have very different effects in animals. And this drug is effectively behaving as a mu delta kappa opioid receptor antagonist with a lot of mu antagonism. That's quite different than naltrexone. And the approval is not just in schizophrenia, but in bipolar 1 disorder, mania mixed and maintenance. And the approval was really granted, grandfathering some of the older olanzapine studies. So samidorphan has been shown to be safe, shown to be able to mitigate the weight gain of olanzapine. So representing, I think, almost a re-opportunity for olanzapine, a drug that was very popular in bipolar 1 disorder for quite some time, and understood, understandably, sort of went to the
back bleachers a little bit because of the weight gain issue. So this is a new way to think about it, and it's a new opportunity for people who might be candidates for olanzapine. Antidepressants, they just don't really work that well. In bipolar 1 disorder, the switch risk is not very high. When you prescribe an antidepressant, the concern is not so much the switch. The concern is actually they just don't work. Switching can happen. Destabilization can certainly happen. But it doesn't happen very often. It's more that they don't work. So one of the ARS questions was, what's the most frequently prescribed class of medications for people with bipolar disorder in America? The answer is antipsychotics. They're the most frequently prescribed. Lithium and valproate have really dropped off. Antidepressants come in number 2. Now, I don't really mind valproate dropping off because it didn't really work that well for maintenance. It's not a very good antidepressant. It treats mania, and it has a whole bunch of side effects as well as safety concerns. And the risk, the teratogenic risks, not just anatomical teratogenicity, but also cognitive and behavioral teratogenicity, is much higher than we thought. And maybe where you guys live, everyone plans pregnancies. But in Toronto, no one plans them. And so I always assume no one's planning the pregnancy. So valproate, I don't mind it going into the past. But lithium should be probably prescribed more than we're prescribing it. Here's a study I want to share with you that really kind of changes our world a little bit insofar as antidepressant monotherapy in bipolar disorder. That sounds like something we should never do. But turns out the evidence supports the safety and the efficacy of antidepressant monotherapy in BP2 in some cases. And I would not do this in a case of rapid cycling or someone who has mixed features or someone who has a history of destabilizing on an antidepressant, but the evidence does support this behavior in some cases. And that's something I wanted to leave with you because that's a bit of an area that's a bit misunderstood. The destabilization risk is higher in BP1 than it is in BP2. Right now, we still kind of anguish this issue because do no harm is the guiding principle always in medicine. And when we're reaching for any medicine for a person with bipolar, my goodness, you don't want to make life worse. But there are data supporting antidepressant monotherapy in BP2, and this is just a drop-down menu of considerations, which are mostly common sense, that you might consider when prescribing an antidepressant in BP2. Do psychostimulants increase the risk of switch in bipolar disorder? No, not higher than placebo, they don't. And this was a study showing that when you prescribe a mood stabilizer, which is MS, which is an outdated moniker, the overall switch risk is no higher in this group. If you're not giving them a mood stabilizer, the risk is elevated. So psychostimulants should be added to mood stabilizing agents like atypicals, lithium, lamotrigine. And when you do that, the risk is not higher. And you're being asked about this all the time because about 1 in 5 people with bipolar meet the criteria for ADHD, and a higher percentage have cognitive complaints. In the remaining couple of minutes, I'll just say the following. We're looking at many new targets in this area, and I'm not going to get into all the details of this. Metabolic drugs, in fact, we just are looking at whether insulin sensitization could improve bipolar depression outcomes, anti-inflammatory drugs, list goes on and on. Tomorrow, during my depression presentation, we're going to talk a lot about glutamate and, of course, ketamine. But the ketamine story is the first inning of the baseball game. There's many, many, many agents that are being looked at that can engage glutamate. And this is a really, really interesting and opportunistic story. We've been able to show that in bipolar depression, ketamine, racemic intravenous infusion, is safe and effective. And it's been shown, in fact, to not have a higher risk of mania or psychosis or dissociation than their MDD, major depressive disorder, counterparts. We've just embarked on a very large repeat dose study in bipolar depression to look at the safety and efficacy of this more with a real attention to suicidality, because that is an area we just haven't been able to do as well in our patients. This is some data showing a reduction, not just in depression, but a reduction in those malignant mixed features in people who have bipolar depression. You all know suvorexant, lamborexant. They're drugs that are so-called dual orexin receptor antagonists. These are drugs that have also been shown to have benefits on mood and cognition. And there's an interesting story unfolding now, that some of these drugs might be antidepressants. In fact, one of them, at least, more than one actually, is being studied as an antidepressant, a drug called seltorexant. So in my bipolar patients, patients with bipolar disorder, I have gravitated more to the orexin antagonist to help with their omnipresent sleep problems because it helps, it reduces the arousal, which is a major problem, and also may have some additional benefits on these other areas. I've certainly seen it. I've kind of fallen a little out of love with N-acetylcysteine. This is an antioxidant. There's a good story why we give antioxidants in bipolar disorder, but the data have been underwhelming. This is the most recent meta-analysis. Bit of a two thumbs down, frankly, didn't quite work. I think we need to understand who should get these treatments. In other words, we need to understand those predictors a bit better. ECT, underutilized, certainly the treatment that is of choice and the most resistant, the most malignant of depression. And it is as effective in bipolar depression as it is in major depression. There's some nice data coming out with the transcranial direct current showing this can be helpful for some patients with bipolar depression. TMS is not studied as much in bipolar depression as ECT, but we do have now compelling evidence. I would see it as being a treatment alternative now in bipolar depression. Lithium reduces suicide. Lithium's been shown to be a agent that delays the onset of episodes, and a really tantalizing story that lithium might also reduce Alzheimer's disease, which is elevated in bipolarity. It's been known to reduce amyloid as well as hyperphosphorylated tau deposition in the brain. Cognition, what's the treatment for cognition and bipolarity? Prevention. Stop using so much weed, alcohol, get some sleep. Those ice cream cone-sized joints have got to go, okay? Less alcohol, less benzodiazepines. Lose some weight. Lose some weight. It's highly procognitive. Let's get the insulin resistance corrected. Those are all prevention strategies. Now, the poly pill nobody wants to swallow, of course, is exercise. Most people would prefer to swallow a porcupine than swallow exercise. And so that has been shown to be procognitive. But we're looking at a variety of treatments. Some of these atypicals I talked about. It's tantalizing to think about the orexin antagonist as well. But we do have some data for cognitive remediation as helping cognition. This is not widely available, but maybe now with some of the technology and the online care we provide, this might be more ubiquitous and more available at point of care. I'm not going to go through the guidelines. I just wanted to bring to your attention the Florida Psychotherapeutic Guidelines. They are free of charge. They're downloaded online, circa 2020, the most updated U.S.-originated guidelines for bipolarity. We just adapted it here for level one treatment in bipolar depression. Lurasidone or lumateperone, alone or monotherapy, or adjunct to lithium valproate. And of course, we have quetiapine and lumateperone for bipolar II disorder. And I'm hoping these will be updated again in the next year or so, but they are the most updated guidelines. Download them from the Florida Psychotherapeutic Guidelines website. The summary is we've got to get this diagnosis timely and accurate, decrease the duration of untreated illness, and increase the fidelity to the evidence-based treatments. We can do it. And the good news is when we do that successfully, the illness trajectory is very, very much favorably affected.